On October 21st, 2018, an 89-year-old man passed away in the small southeastern Oklahoma town of Idabel. His name was Harold Stevenson. He was born in the same town in 1929. In the decades between, he painted big paintings and lived an even bigger life, an artist's life, in New York, Paris, Key West, and the Hamptons, becoming best friends with Andy Warhol along the way. But I bet you've never heard of him. For much of the past decade, Diane Jordan has been trying to rectify that, researching Stevenson's life, gathering an archive, and laying the groundwork for a definitive biography. When not diving into crates and sorting through the minutiae of a life, Diane is a senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Texas Permian Basin. In other words, she's busy. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential.
I suppose the place where I would want to begin is just trying to understand how you came to be part of this endeavor to chronicle the life of Harold Stevenson, kind of share his work, his life, make him, I think some of the efforts you're making are to make him a more known part of the 20th century pop art movement. And, you know, why is this a project you're taking on? How did you get involved with it?
It's actually an amazing story that Harold Stevenson is from Idabel, Oklahoma, and I'm from the same McCurtain County area. And as I got to know Harold, many people tried to tell his story. They would come in from Los Angeles and New York and Paris and Greece, and they'd walk in with their fancy selves and their accents, and they sort of got turned away. And I think what made this possible is I am one of them. This is my home too. I know Harold's family. I knew of Harold. And I thought maybe I am the right person to tell his story. And I'm not an art major, so I really didn't know a lot about art. I didn't know a lot about Harold Stevenson, but I'm a sociologist and I'm interested in qualitative research methods and content analysis. So I went to do an oral history interview with Harold for 1 hour. And after listening to him for an hour, I realized that this was a lifelong project. He was Andy Warhol's lost pop star. How come nobody had ever heard of him? He was kicked out of the Guggenheim. He exhibited on the Eiffel Tower. Life magazine was going to do a big spread on him. And every time like his moment was about to happen, something bad happened to Harold. The Guggenheim kicked him out in 63 for the six painters and the object because Lawrence Alloway, the curator, wanted it to be a group show with the six artists. And he said, oh, Harold, if we include you, it's too magnificent. All the world's attention will be on you. And so he was kicked out and they replaced him with Robert Rauschenberg, who he attended Art Students League with in 1949. That's how Harold got out of Oklahoma. And when I asked him about that, his stories just seemed too fantastic to be real and too dramatic. And so as a sociologist, I tried to get the facts to find out if his stories were true. And they were true, and really disheartening that Harold's place was never recognized in the academy that he deserved to be in. And I contacted Art Students League to see if Harold was indeed enrolled at their school in 1949. He said he'd won a national scholarship to attend. And Harold's very dramatic when he talks. He said, darling, I had to win that scholarship. It was my only way out of Oklahoma. And I got on that train and went to New York City. And so when I contacted the school, they said, no, they didn't have any records of Harold. And they didn't deny that he had been there. They just said, we don't have records going back that far. So I set that aside. 6 years later, I contacted them again, and they said, oh, and it was the same registrar. She remembered me asking the first time, and she said, oh, yes, and here's his registration card, because they had digitized all their materials since I had last asked. And it did show that he had taken classes there at Art Students League with Rauschenberg in 49. So how do I verify that Harold's stories are true? And he had a friend from junior high, a pen pal that was from a nearby town. And so on a whim, I Googled her, and she would have been 83 years old at the time. I half expected a obituary, but instead I got a phone number and I called her, and she answered the phone. And I said, oh, I understand you're a friend of Harold Stevenson's. And she starts crying. And I thought, uh-oh, I've said something wrong. I've done something wrong. And she said, no, you're an angel. I have breast cancer and 6 months to live, and I'm cleaning out my apartment. And I have 50 years worth of letters from Harold. Who would want them? And 2 days later, the FedEx box showed up on my doorstep with letters beginning in 1940s all the way through the 2000s, back and forth with her and Harold. And I realized that this was a window, a front row seat to the birth of the pop movement. Harold was in New York in the early 50s. He arrived in 49 through the 60s and then back and forth through the 80s. And he would write her a letter. Edie, meaning Edie Sedgwick from Andy Warhol, Edie and I attended the Max Ernst exhibition, and Salvador Dali wanted to take his picture with us. And the letters and the photographs and the exhibition catalogs and the posters of all these events that he sent her back to Oklahoma to make her a part of his story validated for me that his story was real and that it did deserve to be told. So I started looking for other people, and I found his 95-year-old agent living in Miami, and he would send me documents and letters, and we'd talk on the phone. I found his next-door neighbor from when he was a child, 3 years old, and she was 93 years old, and I found her grandchildren on social media and was able to connect with her, and she loves hearing from me, and we talk all the time now, and she had letters, and she had slides, Kodak slides, from when Harold made the Life magazine photo exhibit that got pulled because the Navy blew up one of their own ships. And so his story got lost again. So she sent me all her slides, and they're fabulous. They show Harold painting in the 1960s and some of his models. So all her letters from him, they've given to me.
He seems as if, and I didn't know of Harold Stevenson until probably a few years before he passed away in 2018. And the story that I first heard was the story of this large-scale mural painting that he did for the Guggenheim that was rejected and was eventually purchased by the Guggenheim in the early 2000s. I had been to the Guggenheim, you know, many, many times. Had never, you know, it's not been on view as far as I know, or at least not when I've been there. So I knew some of those basic stories, and then, you know, he passed away in 2018. And as I kind of look more into his work and his life, and you know, even seeing what you're doing through having, you know, even a presence on Instagram where you're sharing stuff about him, it seems as if he was this kind of Zelig-like, Gump-like character who just was always around something interesting happening. But instead of it just being him around something interesting happening, it seems like you're making a lot of the point that he was the interesting thing that was happening too, you know, and people... he wasn't just an observer, obviously. He was a participant in all these different things that were going on.
Absolutely, Jeff. I mean, when you think about him being kicked out of the Guggenheim, which lost him his recognition in 63, in the document. So in the end, Harold's family gave me all his papers and archives because they weren't so interested in the papers. I mean, they were interested in his art from their favorite uncle, their only uncle from that side. And all these letters from Sal Mineo and Timothy Willoughby, the two people involved in the early 60s in Paris for the New Adam painting, And the fact that Irie Claire printed the full letter rejecting Harold by the Guggenheim in her newsletter that was distributed worldwide. And I believe a lot of that incident was why Harold was banned from the Guggenheim, was they were embarrassed that this letter had been publicly sent. It was the social media of the day, was her newsletter. And the other thing was Harold was involved with a member of the British royal family, Timothy Willoughby. And that's when the, you know, the media was on the British for that pro forma affair. I forgot how to pronounce that. But I think those political things were part of the reason that Harold was rejected by the Academy. And if you look at his artwork, I mean, he's in Yale, he's in the Smithsonian, you know, he's got some wonderful pieces out there. But as you said, they're not being shown. They're always in the basement. They're always in the archives. And the show that Richard Feigen gave Harold in 63 was a fabulous show, about 24 of his main pieces. You know, it included The New Adam, The Eye of Lightning Billy, Salminio's Navel, The Foot of Irie Claire. It was just a fabulous 24-piece exhibition that went to, first it went to Chicago, and they played Billy Wilder's Some Like It Hot, and that was the opening announcement for that. And then it went to Los Angeles on January the 4th, 1964. And that's where Richard Feigen played Andy Warhol's first film, Harold, at that exhibition. And in the early 2000s, when the Andy Warhol Film Archives book came out, Harold read it. He was very well read. He kept up with the news. And he wrote them a letter and said, that's not correct. That wasn't Andy's first film. And they were very polite. And they said, well, prove it. And he said, okay. And he digs out his announcement card from the Feigen Gallery that shows, please join us for Andy Warhol's film, Harold. And so they recently republished the book, and Harold gets a nice, almost full page in it as they talk about the film Harold that's lost. As I'm going through these archives, I've been working on this about 7 years. I think we have a really good idea of where that film is. It's not in Harold's archives, but I think I know where it is. And I think that would help the world know that Harold, as you said, was in the place, and he was an artist, and he deserves to be recognized.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by Exhibition Merch. You came to see the show, it blew your mind, now you need some stuff. T-shirts, mugs, tote bags, postcards, keychains, etc. Don't forget that fully illustrated catalog. How will anyone know you have this experience if you don't have the merchandise to prove it? Wow, they'll think, this guy must really love museums. Pick up some Exhibition Merch and represent.
So do you view this work as, because it seems as if you say that, you know, you're doing a little bit of detective work, trying to hunt all this stuff down, and your background is sociology, you're not a traditional biographer, but this is a project that you just said you've spent 7 years on and have many years to go on this journey. Do you see this as your life's work kind of at this point? You found something that you... are going to end up dedicating a decade plus of your life to when all is said and done? If not, you're kind of positioning yourself as, you know, this is your project at this time. There's a website, haroldstevenson.com, that kind of is a place where a lot of this work is being collected. How do you see yourself in position to Harold Stevenson?
Well, that's funny. I certainly never thought I would be involved in the art world. Raised on a farm in Southeast Oklahoma, having never been to a museum and really didn't know anything about art, but I sure have learned. And you're right. I mean, I guess every academic's goal is to find a research project that nobody else has done. And again, my Harold Stevenson project just started out as a 1-hour oral history interview. And now I'm consumed by it. because I'm determined that he will be known for the contributions he made to the pop art movement and art in general, and also to disadvantaged populations. You know, Harold was excessively flamboyant in 1949 when he arrived in New York City, and not many people could do that and get by with it. But Harold paved the way and protected so many people that couldn't be themselves, whether they were gay or, you know, not from New York, not part of the art establishment, the self-taught artist. He protected a lot of the artists and gays that were engaged in the military, because his benefactors and patrons were U.S. senators, United Nations ambassadors, West Point instructors. And he kept this all very quiet, and he didn't receive accolades for what he did to help promote these other artists and people so that they could have successful careers. And it'll be the last thing I ever do, which is to make sure that Harold is known. Mm. And one of the things that takes a long time is I do have a full-time teaching job. And so that keeps me pretty busy. And I have a heavy, I'm a senior lecturer, so I teach a 5-5 load, and that doesn't give me time for research. And these archives are all paper and not all organized. And so it's pretty tedious for me to be able to go through them in my spare time in order to get this project done. So I do feel like it's a lifelong project. If there's anything I can say about COVID that was good, is that it has certainly allowed people to work from home. And from Broken Bow, Oklahoma, Southeast Oklahoma, it's not easy to get to an airport. Texarkana is the closest airport. So I can't just jump on a plane or a train and go to New York or the Getty or the archives and get this data that is there about Harold. But I can get online. And because of COVID, many librarians have agreed to send me documents so that they verify Harold's work in these places.
Yeah, the circumstances kind of forced a digitization or a cooperation with places that were strictly on the premises only white glove organizations beforehand. So that definitely has been an upside in this. I'm curious, you mentioned Harold's flamboyance, and I was thinking about someone, obviously Harold will always be tied to Andy Warhol. Andy Warhol was certainly not ever hiding the fact that he was gay, but there was an androgyny to him, especially early on, where it wasn't necessarily the center of his discussion. And then you think about contemporaries like Robert Rauschenberg or Jasper Johns, who very much purposely grayed and blurred the lines between, you know, their sexuality and never quite came out publicly with those things. Do you think that his being so upfront about it was one of the things that hindered his opportunities at the time or his exposure in the larger public consciousness?
Absolutely, it did. And again, that's why I admire Harold, maybe not only just for his artwork, but for the fact that Harold was who he was, and he didn't lie about it. He didn't hide it, but he also helped protect people. You know, Harold Stevenson met Andy Warhol in 1949 when they both Andy arrived in New York in July, and Harold got there in August. And so they immediately became fast friends because they were not part of the establishment. And Harold was flamboyant. He was good looking. He was verbose. He was fun. And Andy was still shy. He was not a confident speaker. You know, he came from an immigrant's family. He was sickly, had a pockmarked face. He did not consider himself attractive. And Harold will always tell you he was attractive from the time he was a youth. And so they were a perfect foil against each other, and they became great friends. And, you know, that whole group, they all started out as starving artists in New York, painting window displays and doing window design to pay for their food and their rent. And that's absolutely that he was out, and he was not afraid to be out. And he paved the way for many other people. And some will say, when I tried to track down more information about the six painters and the object and why he was banned and what the other artists thought about it, I did appreciate that Jasper Johns and Jim Dine both responded to me with their thoughts about what happened and what they could or could not add to that discussion. But I do feel like the powers that be in art media weren't ready for someone like Harold to be that flamboyant, and they were afraid of him. I think they were afraid.
Harold begins his life, as you mentioned, there in Idabel, Oklahoma, which is, for those listening, in the southeastern corner of the state, an area known somewhat as Little Dixie, you know, kind of the most kind of southern antebellum part of Oklahoma in many ways. And he then ends up spending all this time in New York, living abroad, all these things, ends up, though, coming back to Idabel, and was living there when he passed away in 2018. I'm curious, as we wrap up this conversation, because there's so much to go there, but I am curious, how did he end up making his way back there? And was it a good thing for him to kind of return to the place where he began to end those last few years of his life?
Harold went back to Idabel many, many times after he left in 1949. And whenever he was in New York, he said, I need to be home because that's where my inspiration is and that's where I can paint. And then he would get home and say, oh, I can't stay in this box. I must get back to the city. So no matter where he was, he always wanted to be back in the other place. And so for decades and decades, he would go from Paris to Idabel, from Rome to Idabel, from New York to Idabel, San Francisco to Idabel. And I think that did keep him going. And it also made him have fresh eyes when he did go back to the city. It was after a trip abroad that he wrote Andy Warhol a letter after the Sidney Janis exhibition in 62, The New Realist. Do you realize this is a new movement, Andy? You're the father. It's called pop art. It's the pop movement. Because he had been away from New York, and so he could see with those fresh eyes.
So having that distance, that dichotomy of experience was a plus for him in a lot of ways, having the ability to kind of see the, you know, kind of love-hate relationship that I think a lot of people have with wherever they're from. Doesn't matter if you're from Idabel, Oklahoma, or from Paris or anywhere else. You have kind of that gotta get away, gotta get back mentality that you take with you. I'm curious, you're very much in the middle of this project. You know, what's next? Are we looking at, you know, and I will say, I mentioned this earlier, there's an Instagram feed people can follow. There's a website, haroldstevenson.com, where you can kind of keep up with some of the ongoing research. There's a blog and different components there. But, you know, how far are we away from a book? How far are we away from, you know, do you see a documentary down the road? There's so many opportunities with this. What's your dream scenario and what do you think is doable?
It's all doable. It just takes time and money. So my original project is simply to get his biography told. And that's still my main purpose, is what I'm working on, is to get the biography finished. But the archives need to be digitized. I keep thinking there's something major in one of these boxes that I haven't gone through yet. And what if I'm missing something? So I am desperate to try to get the archives digitized and sorted. He definitely needs a documentary. It has all the elements of, you know, drama, fame, sadness, love, as these major events happen to him. I really want Harold to have a renaissance. I want Harold to have another exhibition that he deserves. Of the 24 pieces that Feigen showed in 63, I have found about half of them, a little over half. And they're scattered all over the world and in Oklahoma and in the U.S. Harold's artwork needs to be shown, and I'd like for him to have an exhibit again.
In 1964, Harold Stevenson exhibited a 40-foot-tall painting of a famous matador on the Eiffel Tower. This was done with the full permission of the French government, but was only up for a few days after causing traffic jams around the tower and plenty of distracted drivers. Some pedestrians even attempted to climb the structure to get a closer look, An article on the project in the New York Times called it, quote, the world's biggest easel. That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. Additional production assistance from Jack Dean. Theme music by Broncho. For more on the museum and the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. As always, we suggest both. Until next time, look closer.